As a reminder, this is part two of the audience Q&A section of the live recording I did with Jack Butcher from Visualize Value. Check out part one in your podcast feed. Just scroll back down if you haven't already heard the interview part where Jack transparently shared his 2020 revenue breakdown, and we discussed the evolution of the creator economy and unique ways creators are building businesses. Let us know what you think of this on Twitter. I'm at BZady and he's Jack Butcher. Now let's get straight into the show. Chris asked a question about building an audience on Twitter. Do you want to just read that and get on with it, or do you want me to read that, sure, the whole thing?
No, I could do it. So okay, cool. Chris asked, build an audience on Twitter. How do you think about finding a niche? Matthew Kobach says it's the best way to grow, but I would love to hear your thoughts. So I think, the niche conversation is really like nuanced. I wrote something a couple weeks ago where it's like, you don't really pick a niche picks you. So it's kind of this, it's this weird experiment between making a ton of noise and just talking about what you're interested in, publishing work you're doing, and then just start to find the people that latch onto that stuff and then essentially figure out what they have in common, why they're interested in what you're putting out. So Visualize Value started to attract people that are interested in self-development, entrepreneurship, health and fitness, all of that kind of stuff. So that basically allowed me to start asking questions to those people, like, what is it you value about this? What are you interested in? And then more importantly, what do you need help with? What are you working on? All of these kinds of things. So the niche kind of emerges as a byproduct, I would say, of finding something that you can do sustainably. Because that, if you can't figure that out, then there's no reason to build into that niche anyway. So I think from an economic perspective, some people can do this where it's like, hey, there's great opportunity in like portable toilets right now. You should go into that. Some people can do that. Like if you want to start a content business and you're going to be the person producing the content, you probably want to do it around something that you're interested in. So that's my like my bit on niches. I think the identifying that and then identifying a format that you can do consistently is really important. So in Bilal's case, if you can interview 3 people a week, start a podcast. If you can, you know, write these really articulate articles or tweet threads or whatever, then you should lean into that. It's about finding the sustainable deliverable to start building that mechanism for like finding feedback.
But yeah, that's awesome, man. So the next one, we can just try to fire off a few of these. Differentiating best relationship between personal brand and another product. So yeah, this question's about differentiating between the personal brand and a product or website brand.
I wrote something about this. I think it's a module in Build Once, Sell Twice. So it was, you know, again, in hindsight, the Visualize Value brand has created optionality. It's created like, you know, the ability to like detach this thing from yourself if you ever wanted to. It's like an entity that exists without you. It would be, you know, that's a huge process to do that, but ultimately it's possible. I think there's definitely something to be said for like, if you wanted to own an aesthetic or a style of publishing something, it feels to me like you can build brand equity that way. And I'm like, my background as a designer has like influenced that decision more than I can even tell you. I think if you don't have this like burning desire to communicate in a very consistent way and a skill set that like is biased towards that, it may just be splitting your effort into two places when you really don't need to.
The next one is about repurposing across multiple platforms. This is quite an interesting question. It's probably quite useful for us to go through. I have some ideas on this too, but does anything resonate with you?
It depends on the scale of the idea. Like if you're talking about literally a piece of content, obviously you can like take a podcast and chop it into like different bits and turn it into tweets and write an article and things of that nature. But I think if you're talking about an idea at like a different level, like you know, permissionless apprenticeship, build once, sell twice, this idea of packaging like a philosophy or a way of operating, then you can basically showcase the results of that idea on these different platforms. So like for Build Once, Sell Twice, we've got you know, people who go through that course and then create something like build a business or start a service or build a product, and taking the case study from that, like from their experience onto all these different platforms. So interview them on YouTube, like do a thread of visuals that becomes an article on one of our websites, and then take that over to Twitter and summarize that visually. I think it's more like, I think this is a Gary V principle, right? It's like your ability to adapt to like the culture of each platform is really where the wins start to happen. Another great lesson I learned from Austin Reef is
that's the Morning Brew guy, right?
Yeah, he's basically says if you want more people to read your email newsletter, then advertise in email newsletters. So a lot of the time, I think we're kind of splitting our effort again over three or four platforms for no real reason. Like we need to figure out what type of person we want to get in touch with, the most effective vehicle for getting in touch with them, and then, you know, going out and creating things on the platform that gives us the highest, the best shot at doing that. So not a definitive answer. I hope it's helpful though, but.
I think that's a great answer. One thing I'd add, and like anything creative, there's no right or wrong answer. Like you said, it's definitely on a scale. So there's a few thoughts I have. The first is prioritize, like first of all, figure out what your goals are, because I think a lot of people think, okay, I'm just going to create something and I'm going to create all this multiple pieces of content and put it everywhere on all the different platforms. I think, you know, if you're Gary V and you've got 25 people working for you, that's what he does by this point. Oh, sorry, he has thousands of people working for him, but 25 people just helping him with his personal brand, essentially. And to be fair, the caveat with Gary is he did a lot of this on his own back in the day, and he works incredibly hard. But nowadays, the algorithms are very different. The organic reach is very different. And you're not just going to create something that then gets 50% or 80% of people who follow you on Facebook to see it. Or Instagram to see it. The organic reach rates on Facebook are like 1% to 5% and about 5% to 10% or 15% on Instagram. So that means if you've got 1,000 people following you, only 10% or 15% of them are even going to see your stuff. So if you multiply that across TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, YouTube, podcasts, etc., you're going to see that you're very quickly going to dilute what you're doing, right? So it's something I tried doing for a long time and I kind of ran out of steam, and now I've really focused in on YouTube, podcasts, and Twitter and my main channels. I will hopefully do more on YouTube, on Instagram again. And someone in the chat, Adil, has just shared the 64 pieces of content approach from Gary V. So I definitely think that's really interesting. So I would say prioritize what you're trying to do. To pick one or two platforms as your core. If you're able to repurpose stuff, then that's great. But if you think of that as like the main pillar content, so for me, it's a long podcast, right? I prepare a few hours for our conversation. I write all these questions. We talk for 1 or 2 hours and then we edit. So that's a long time. But then that 1 or 2 hours gets turned into tweets, into 1-2 minute clips. And I can use those for months, essentially. So that is kind of how I approach it.
And I'd say one thing that you do well in your, like, when you move some of that stuff over to Twitter, like we talked about this phenomenon of like Joe Rogan's first podcast being an absolute disgrace, right? It's just like messing around, like, how's the mic work? And you picked out that like 30-second exchange between you and I, and then like further contextualize that with, here's a clip from that podcast. Here's another example of somebody else. So it's like taking these bits and then adding context, as opposed to, here's a clip from my podcast, go listen to the episode. It's like
completely
the like diversion of attention. You really think you're going to stop somebody from scrolling Twitter? Like, hang on a minute, I was scrolling Twitter, but I'm just going to go and listen to Bilal's podcast right
for
now.
For an hour.
The chances of that happening,
it's not happening.
Close to none. Even if you have, like, you know, I think there are probably exceptions to the rule if you're like, you've got 10 million listeners, but there's like a bit of arrogance in some of our behavior, I think, that prevents us from getting the best results sometimes as well.
Yeah. And just one last thing I'll add on that approach. Thanks for that example. I think it's definitely one that I've improved. is also thinking about what's valuable to that person on Twitter at that moment. And Polina Marinova Pompliano was this last week's episode, and she's a masterful writer, and she worked a fortune for a long time. And one of the questions, one of the things she taught me was about editing and what she's looking at to take out stuff, right? Because in an age of limited attention for people, that's what you're trying to do, is make sure it's so good and you've taken the fat out that it's worth their time. And I can't remember all the questions. It's on my Twitter. If you go to it, I just published it today, like the three questions she asked herself, but something along the lines of, does this serve the user? Does it support my point? And is this for my ego? Well, those are three common things people often do. One other thing I do want to add is Tim Urban, who's one of the best writers on the internet. He shared this recently, and he talked about, if you're creating content on the internet, there's four types of content. One is someone didn't like it. Two, they thought it was solid and fine. Three, they really liked it. And four, they absolutely loved it. And he argues that you should really only try to create the fourth type, which is they loved it, because anything that's just like solid or fine, it's not going to spread. Like, it's maybe better for you to spend that time, twice the amount of time, to create something so good that it's worth the time. So even when I think about this podcast, I say, what can I reasonably do? What sort of cadence can I reasonably create something of a high level where the guest is really good, where we do great show notes, we cut out the fat, we create the clips, and people notice that. They say, oh wow, that's, you've only got good guests. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's because I don't do 1,000. I do, you know, a few hundred. That's kind of how I'm trying to do it. So I'll share that link as well. But I think the way Tim Urban thinks about it is really, really interesting too.
Another example on that, a guy called Michael Simmons has this thing, similar idea, blockbuster strategy for Medium. So this idea that like you spend 3 months writing a Medium article and it will get you like 15 million views. It's like this incredible piece of work. And I'm like, that definitely becomes true, especially when you even have a little bit of distribution. If you shift your focus in that direction, like, I think the upside is huge. We're just like distracted little monkeys, and we just want to press the button and get the feedback, right?
Yeah. I do want to address one, Bram, who I think's calling in from the Netherlands. Thanks for joining today, Bram. He made a really good point. He said, there's a lot of argument about quality versus quantity. There's people I respect on both sides. What I'll just say to that, I completely agree. I think what we have said throughout this conversation is that you need both, essentially. You need enough, but you need it to be of a good enough level. So if you just made one thing once a year, it's very likely it's not going to find too much attention on the internet in the way we're speaking about it. It's different if you're creating a film, obviously, right? So my opinion is you create that really great piece of long form or whatever it is, and then you can turn that into hundreds of pieces of content through tweets and all the micro content we discussed. And I definitely agree with you, Bram. It's not one size fits all approach either way.
All right. Camilo asks, how could a photographer productize a service? So I've seen a few iterations of this. Like, I think on the like way on the end of product is like presets, courses, digital assets. Like, if you can build a massive reputation, then I think you have a ton of leverage to be able to do that. So there's good examples of people doing that, but it's like more of a big audience play. I think the productizing the service, to me, it's things like, I work exclusively with direct-to-consumer brands, and I do like lifestyle product shoots. So I'll get you 1,000 pieces of content in the next year if you ship me all your product and you pay me X. And that idea that you can, you know, maybe you specialize in, I don't know, electronics or gadgets or something, and you just figure out a way, put those in really interesting places, lifestyle product shoots, things of that nature, where you just start to build up an expertise in what type of imagery is converting in that space. And then you offer that as a productized service, and then you can systemize it and things of that nature. But again, like outcome-based, I would just think outcome-based, like who needs photography that is either really bad at it, or, you know, they can make a huge difference in their business by investing more in it. And then the other component is, if you want to productize this, there has to be like, there can only be one or two variables that changes. So if it's, you know, if you're shooting direct to consumer product, you could just get it shipped to you and shoot it. If it's like, I've been in the film production and photography space, and you can't, like, a lot of it just cannot be productized. It's like, you have to travel here, you have to get talent, you have to hire this. So I think you want to control as many of the variables as possible and then figure out an outcome-based pitch for a very specific type of person. Hopefully that helps.
Hot take on this quick. Had you answered a question, why should I care as a contemporary R&B and pop music artist with a small core fan base that's growing?
Nate, I don't know how much time you're spending with your current fan base, but maybe that's like the first place to look is like, you know, why do you listen to my work? When do you listen to my work? Who else do you listen to? I think isn't the idea that you can, I mean, permissionless apprenticeship might be an interesting model in this world too, like collaborations and like sounds that go with yours. I don't know a ton about the music industry, but I do think there is like an inherent virality. And we should also link to the Lil Nas X case study that Harry Dry did, which is basically Lil Nas X got his first song to trend by putting it on the back of a bunch of memes and then like circulating the memes. So it's like finding this interesting distribution or finding media that people already have some emotional attachment to. And depending on the vibe of your music, could you attach that to something that already has some cultural velocity? And then people are like, whose song is this? It's Nate Proctor's song. So I hope that's helpful.
Thoughts on Bitcoin?
I'm not a fiduciary. Couldn't possibly comment.
Well, first of all, neither of us are advising to do any investing in things you can't afford to invest in or lose. We were talking about this last night because Meek Mill and Pomp were pumping Bitcoin heavily. Well, not just them, everyone was, which is fun. And I'll just share from my side, I'm a hodler of Bitcoin. I'm a big fan of the long-term potential of blockchain specifically. And then my bet is on Bitcoin being the primary, you know, version of like digital gold is the current thesis, which seems to have a lot of legs behind it. But definitely I would only put in an amount that you feel comfortable losing if it went to zero, because it's incredibly volatile. And sometimes you see the swings in the amounts of money that's going up and down, and it's kind of scary. So like my approach has been to lock it up somewhere so that I don't have to even be tempted to sell anything. And I've been holding Bitcoin for a long time. What about you, Jack? Anything you want to comment on that?
I think I'm in the same camp, you know, like idealistic, it's a cool idea and you want to see it succeed because of the massive on the bull case, and the optimist case for it is really attractive and interesting. I would say, like, just from a personal perspective, I'm way more focused on making money than figuring out where to put my money in this stage of my life, at least. And I think that's another like common problem when we get into like the original point of this talk, which is the creator economy and the passion economy. It's like everybody's trying to be an investor. They don't have any money to invest. Like, I'm way more interested in talking to people about how to build a skill that the market's going to pay you for. And then you've got money to chuck into Bitcoin if you want to. Reality is like your skill is the currency that is going to keep you alive regardless of what you're buying your bread with. So I think the point in which you're getting like turning into a billionaire overnight with Bitcoin is probably past at this point, right? You can make a ton of money if you hold it for another 10 years and it becomes the like entire financial system. I think even if that happens, it's only now, I don't know, 10x or something return, which is obviously stupid, but not anything like it was. And again, this is why, like, I love the idea. I love people talking about the idea, but I think it can get a little dangerous when it's like, hey, you know, don't worry about working. Just put your money in Bitcoin and sit in your hands. Like, that's, I don't think that's very good advice.
I love that. And I would put it on a similar plane to, there's a, if you follow the world of FIRE, which is financial independence, retire early crowd, which I would partly say I've kind of dabbled with and I like some of the concepts. But a lot of that crowd can become super focused on saving and like cutting all your costs. And again, there's there's some value in that, and not spending beyond your means and not spending stuff or being so focused on materialistic stuff. But really, like, a lot of people should probably be focusing more of the effort on how can I make a lot more than save $5 on a latte from Starbucks, in my opinion anyway. So I think that kind of answers that, man.
Punkle asks, suggestions on applying the overwhelm the algorithm idea to musicians. I'm going to refer back to the answer that we gave Nate. I think there's a ton of stuff you could do there, like remixing, adding your stuff to things that need music, reaching out to people that are maybe using music illegally and offering them some beneficial relationship. Like, get into those areas where the types of people that are going to listen to your music are going to be. Find creators that can benefit from it. I think there's a few things to be leveraged there. How to minimize risks. I think we talked about this quite a bit. I think, you know, working in a more traditional environment until you have the like escape velocity to go out and charge and like live comfortably while you know, being an entrepreneur or service provider. So I think minimizing risk is like start experimenting before, you know, you're in a position where if your experiment fails, you're like completely desolate. I think that's probably a good place to start. And also, like, the dots looking backwards, like, you'll be, there are loads of things that you can learn while somebody else is paying you that will eventually become these skills that you can leverage in a different position. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got, and I didn't know at the time, so I was like, you know, just didn't understand it at the time. I was like 19 or something, but someone came to speak at our university and said, make your mistakes on somebody else's dime. It's like, you want to go and work at an agency? Because you're going to mess stuff up. You're going to like put the wrong colors on a print job. You're going to miss a deadline. You're going to like, you know, you're going to be on a shoot and somebody's going to like scratch the car you're taking photographs of or something. And if your name is on the contract, you're eating all of that responsibility versus watching all of those mistakes happen and having a, you know, a job.
The skin in the game is only like, is an important concept too, but then there's a time and a place for that too, because when you're really early, you're trying to build skills. So like, my answer to that of minimizing risk really come from building skills that you can monetize, you know, at any moment, right? Like, whether that's a design job, or in my case, it was digital marketing. So like, the way I make a lot of my income now are skills that I learned 10, 15 years ago. And since then I've done a bunch of other stuff, but it's harder for me to sell that skill unless I'm trying to take a job, because not many people want to pay like a senior leader just to be in their like boardroom, but like, they'll more than happily pay you for something that's going to drive revenue for them. And so I'd say like learning, but also making sure you're hedging your bets the way you talked about earlier. Like, the service part of that approach is a way to hedge your bets. So like, when I've quit my job a couple of years ago, I went the other direction where I was like, I had no income for a while, because I was like, oh, I'll figure it out. Like, I had some savings I'd saved up. But after a while, especially like living in New York, you know, I was spending $5,000-$6,000 a month just on like rent and food and all that sort of stuff. And even if you've got $1 million in the bank, it starts to hurt after a while, like seeing that number go down. And it's dependent on the person. Like, some people are completely fine with that, but for me, it was difficult to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I've been in that situation too. And there's also an argument to make for being painted in a corner, because you figure stuff out faster in that situation too. So there's no right answer,
that's true,
as is the case for all of these questions. What are some tactics you use to get momentum when working on a project? Deadlines, public pressure, accountability. Not great tools sometimes, but then on the flip side, like, go for a walk, have a shower, walk the dog, go for a drive. Like, sometimes the momentum is like trying to force something when it's like you just need to defrag a little bit. And I think that is, get away from the screen for an hour and things start to form. It's like the Twitter feed and all those inputs are like so frenetic and so like, you know, I feel like they prevent you from processing at a deeper level sometimes. So momentum, as you know, as counterintuitive as it sounds, it's like go and That's why you have good ideas when you're in the shower, right? Accidentally meditating.
Change your environment for sure. Yeah. And I think I've asked this question to a lot of people on the podcast, and a lot of them say, find something you love so much that isn't just related to a screen. And I know that's very like 2021 to say, like, be away from your phone, but it's really true. Yeah. Like, one of them said he goes skiing, and that's, you know, he lived in Canada and he could go easily, but someone else goes for a run. And it's like someone else will like go and cook, or like Ryan Beagleman, founder of Summit Series, who was on the show, he had an amazing one, which was he goes in the shower in the dark and he puts on music and he dances in the shower. So that's hilarious. I tried that one out. It's definitely worth checking out, because it sounds all ridiculous, right, but in a weird way, you completely like let yourself go and you don't take yourself so seriously at that moment, and you completely refresh your body, right? And Tony Robbins jumps up and down on a trampoline before he goes on stage. So like, there is something about physical movement that I think makes a huge difference.
I just got a late Christmas present from my mother-in-law, a waterproof speaker. So I'll give that a little try later.
Love that.
Sharath asks about social proof. I think Sharath knows my views on social proof. It's been a huge, catalyst in growing what we've been building. I think it's, you know, social, there's like varying degrees of it too. So I think social proof can be a review. It can be like people writing things about your product, but also like the next degree of social proof is something I'm really interested in, which is like, if you're building an education product, then what tools can you give the people that you that use your product, like really tell their story? So we've got now this site, value.app, where we invite people to contribute and write articles on, you know, the transformation that they've experienced. And I think that contextualizes, you know, what people in different situations get out of certain products. So proof is in all forms, I think, is massive. Proof of work in the portfolio of projects you build, and then social proof in like humans buying from humans and generating trust that way. So I'm big on it.
100% social proof is incredibly important, but I'm think of it from a content creator's point of view, from like the podcast, even like getting guests, right? Like early on, there's an element of, hey, I've got this guest, you're like them, come and join, you know, my podcast too. And that's basically how I got Gary Vee, Damon John, all these people before I even had a podcast, before I owned a microphone in many cases. So there's an element of social proof that goes in the pre-sale moment as well. And there's a fine balance between what people say as fake it till you make it, which I'm not necessarily a fan of that phrase, but just like being able to focus on like a vision is another way I'd put it, which is you're not faking, you're just selling a vision. You're saying, this is what I'm building, come and be a part of it. You're showing momentum. And then the social proof was how I sold sponsorships before I launched the podcast as well. So it was to say, hey, I got Gary Vee and I got this person and I have zero audience, but when I launch, I'm going to be sending this out to everyone I know and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I think there's so many use cases for social proof. So I'm definitely a fan as well.
Jeff, all right, we last four here. How do you think about the art and science of managing, maintaining relationships and opportunity at scale? You alluded to too much opportunity when you spoke earlier, prioritizing, managing. Yeah, it's definitely challenging. I think I have, Celia is a huge part of that for me as well. My wife, who's like the general inbox of Visualize Value, goes through Celia. So she's great at filtering things. And I read this great quote by, I'm going to forget his name. Guy Speer. He wrote a book called The Education of a Value Investor. And he just said, like, I think he said, I only ever answer if you're going to articulate the pitch to me in an email. So it's like, if someone's like, hey, can I jump on the phone with you? It's like, no, if you're not going to like spend the time to articulate like why or what's going on, like, I know that this relationship is starting off on the wrong foot in a lot of cases. So
yeah,
I think you can really read somebody's intention. And Bilal, when you reached out about the podcast, it was like, it's a no brainer because it's such a detailed note. It's like, clearly like this person cares about what they're doing. They're trying to, you know, there's a mutually beneficial thing happening here. And you would be so surprised, Jeff, at how infrequent you get messages with that level of thought and care. So I think if you want a huge advantage, honestly, just like do a little bit of research, take a little bit of care, and you will honestly just be in a different class than most people's inboxes. And it gets easy to filter when you start seeing how much effort some people put in.
Yeah, I love that. I'll just add one extra thought on that, which was, so the question was around art and science of managing relationships at scale and opportunity at scale. So one thing I would think about is how people often think about relationships as one-on-one, like I need to be able to text or call this person, which is great. That's the best form of relationship, is in-person text calls, right? But a lot of the time there's time in between, like me and you are texting now, but that took time for me to show you that, hey, I've got this idea. First, like we actually got connected because I just sent you a message on Twitter saying, I really love your work. And that was genuine. Like I wasn't trying to like pitch you. I didn't even think about the podcast necessarily at the time. I just thought, oh, you're a creative person. I'm a creative person. I love what you're doing. I just like sending those random messages to say I appreciate it. And then maybe if that person responds, it turns into something more later, right? But the other thing I've noticed, and this is both personal and business relationships, and my previous jobs, for a lot of people won't know my background, but I worked in partnerships, business development, sales, and marketing. And a lot of those partnerships came from creating relationships over a year plus. And so there's one guy I'm thinking of right now who owns a bunch of restaurants in New York. And when I first met him, it was like he was super cold and not that nice. And he was just like business. He's like, okay, cool. What are you going to do for me? Cool, 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 cool. And then by the end of the meeting, the colleague I was with mentioned I have a podcast. And he's like, oh, that's interesting. He went home, listened to my podcast. By the time we spoke next time, he was like, man, you've been in my ear all week. And that's the thing where I think where people don't always think, like to your point about scale, I wasn't in his ear talking in his ear, right? And we weren't even talking about the original thing. We were talking about like something completely different. So that to me, like putting stuff out where people get used to hearing your voice, reading your work through email, seeing you on Twitter, whatever, not just your like avocado toast on a weekend, but like ideas, things that you actually represent, that is a way to get out to people at scale too. And now, like that person has introduced me to the most incredible people and we're like friends now, but I had to break down that barrier. And a lot of that happened while I wasn't even there. So I would think about how you can, you know, how you can scale your own efforts in that way too.
Yeah, that's great.
Cool. We've got a last couple questions. Rotimi, this is someone from London. He's killing it. And if anyone's interested in rock climbing, you should check out his work. Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, sure. So I haven't heard of the book. He said David Epstein has a book called Range, where he pits the idea of being a generalist versus a specialist. What are your thoughts of being a jack of all trades as a catalyst for success?
No pun intended.
Yeah. I would argue in some worlds, I have like just been exposed enough to be like, you know, reasonably effective at like a handful of things with maybe like one or two skills that are that I've over-indexed on. So I think it's really hard to even define the difference between generalist and specialist. I think the way I think about it is like aligning the business model that best fits your personality. So the idea of being a someone who has to operate within a team versus someone that doesn't need a team. Those like are kind of the two distinctions that I would make instead of like specialist versus generalist. And that's obviously dictated by what you're promising the market. So the outcome is really like, if you're trying to build a social media network, then you need a ton of specialists in every single vertical. But if you want to, you know, build a peanut butter brand and sell it on TikTok, you might be able to get away with doing it by yourself if you're dangerous enough at Shopify and like sourcing ingredients and all that kind of stuff. So that I think the distinction is really about like the environment you want to end up in. And I don't know if generalist and specialist is a helpful distinction anymore, because it's just like, I haven't heard anybody at least describe like a very articulately the difference that would make me think, oh, okay. Those are two very different people. I think it's, depends on your definition of success as well. I just read the last part of your question. It's like being good enough at a few things that you can like hold down 5 or 6 clients, if that's success to you, and that you define that as generalist, great. If you want to make $400,000 a year at Google and you're the like one of the top data scientists in New York, that may be the specialist route. So to each his own, I think, in that situation. Hopefully that's at all interesting, that answer.
Yeah, well, I think that definitely is. And one thing I'd add is just, I like the idea of the expert generalist, which is to say, you know, like you, my approach is really like, I always want to have 20% of my skills to be close to an expert in something, whether that's for you, design and visual storytelling. For me, it's like digital marketing, you know, ads, marketing, stuff like that. The other 80% for me is always about like trying to learn about all sorts of different worlds, especially within the business context. So that's one of the main reasons I have the podcast, is to be able to learn about how different people operate in different worlds. And that helps me with that general knowledge, but that's not for everyone. And some people should just be, you know, if they want to be an academic and be a specialist in like anthropology or whatever they really love, like good for them. You know, that's cool. I think the world needs both. If you're an entrepreneur, you're a business person, I think there's a lot of value in having a wide aperture of understanding in different worlds and being able to link those different worlds, or at least borrow an idea from this world and execute in a different area, which is basically the whole idea of Creator Lab, was to find those people, find the commonalities. So great question. I don't think there's a one size fits all answer, but hopefully that helps. Someone asked a question about the book Almanac of Naval Ravikant, which Jack helped illustrate in, right? And it's by Eric Jorgensen, I think. Book. Also going to come on the podcast soon. So just curious about your experience with that.
Yeah, so the idea that Naval sort of kickstarted a lot of these paradigm shifts for me, and then this, like, at the end of last year, sort of culminating in getting to illustrate some of his ideas and be involved in this project, was just like kind of nuts. And it really gave like wings to the permissionless apprenticeship idea, that is, hey, if like you can get in touch with somebody who's like, the demand on that guy's time has got to be so insane, and to be able to, like, you know, I never spoke with him personally, we're in the same Google document like editing the stuff. And even that is just like, this is crazy, man. Like it's really phenomenal, and Eric's become a really good friend. And, you know, it was all like doing work up front. He never got in touch like, do you want to do this? It was like, hey, I've got these illustrations. I noticed you're writing a book. Here's the stuff. If you want to use it, great. If you have any questions, here's my email. But, you know, no hard feelings either way. And then it just turned into something. And I just shipped off some illustrations for another book that should be, I think, already doing well before it's out. So hopefully
you're not allowed to share the name yet, are you?
Not yet, no. Okay, but, cool. Should be great.
Yeah, no, it's going to be awesome, man. But listen, man, this has been incredible. Thanks so much for sharing that. We just banged that 15 questions as well. So if you're still here, and there's a bunch of you still here, so thanks so much. We know it's late for a lot of you people listening in New Zealand and Europe and the States. So this is definitely something I'd love to try again. It's the first time I've done it. And wait, 4 a.m. in Pakistan. Well, that's incredible, man. Adil, where are you from in Pakistan, by the way? That's where my family's from, Lahore. So that's great. Thanks for joining, brother. This has been incredible. Dallas from Mexico. Jack, anything else we should share with people before we wrap up?
I think so, man. This has been... I think it was a good chat. Loads going on in my head now for stuff to do. So let's keep the conversation going. If there's anything that pops up, get at us on Twitter. And maybe we'll do another one soon if there's demand.
Definitely. Yeah. And just to wrap, for people listening, we'll put we'll probably put this on, I'll probably put this in two parts, I think, on the podcast. So we'll do part one, conversation, and then part two is Q&A. So if you missed any of that, you can listen on there, and then maybe we'll put the video as a full clip on Visualize Value or something like that. But we'll figure it out, and then just share with us like what you thought of this, because it's the first time we did it, things we can improve, things you really liked. I'd love to hear from you as well, at BZAD on Twitter. Jack, you're at Jack Butcher. I think everyone here is already following you, but we'll hear from you guys on there, and thanks again. We'll do this again soon.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks everybody, much appreciated.
Next time we'll get the DJ Dex. All right.
Yeah.
Nice one, man. All right, cheers. Bye-bye.
Nice one, mate. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed the Q&A with Jack and our first ever live recording of Creator Lab. As a reminder, you can sign up to join the next one at creatorlab.fm/live. And if you happen to have listened to the Q&A part but not the full interview, just scroll back on your podcast app to the last episode that's in your feed. And we talk all about the evolution of the creator economy. Jack broke down his 2020 revenue in detail, and we talked about a lot of the concepts that were discussed in the Q&A. If you enjoyed this, I'd love to hear from you on Twitter. I'm at BZAD. Jack is at Jack Butcher. Let us know what you think, and see you next week.